You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you eat energy bars? If so, you have a lot of company. We'll find out how they came on the scene, how they evolved, and what their popularity says about us. First, if you get health insurance benefits with your job, it can work different ways. There might be one plan, take it or leave it, or you might get a choice from some different coverage options. But when it comes to figuring out which plans you get to choose from, that's often something HR departments do with the help of something called an insurance broker. In his latest piece, our next guest took a closer look at that small part of the health insurance industry and the ways it may contribute to rising health insurance costs in the United States. Marshall Allen covers healthcare for ProPublica. His piece is titled, Behind the Scenes, Health Insurers Use Cash and Gifts to Sway Which Benefits Employers Choose. Marshall, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate your interest.
Now, these insurance brokers, this is a part of the healthcare market that I think is probably invisible to most of us. Who are they? What do they do?
Well, so independent health insurance brokers are really advisors to employers. So employers can pick health benefits for their employees. And so the independent brokers will work with all different types of employers, from small employers with under 50 employees all the way up to employers with hundreds or even thousands of employees. And the real catch here is that they're supposed to represent the interests of the employers, and they would say that they do that. But the way that they're paid traditionally is all through the insurance companies. So insurance companies will pay them a base commission. The commission will be based. It works a lot of different ways. So this is there's not a universal way that this works, but traditionally they'll be paid a percentage of the premium. So let's say a company spends, let's say there's 100 people in a company and they spend $1 million a year in premiums. That broker might get 3 to 5% of the total, which would be $30,000 to $50,000. And then in that case, it kind of creates an incentive where if the healthcare costs go up, the broker actually makes more money. They might get a fixed fee. Then they also get bonuses. The bonuses can be based on the total volume of employers they bring to an insurance company. They can be based on the retention of employers. And a lot of this bonus money comes behind the scenes. The employers aren't always told about it, and it's not always disclosed. And so there's a lot of, when I talk to ethics experts and even brokers, they said that this really creates a conflict of interest for the brokers. They're supposed to be advising the employers and getting them the best value, but meanwhile they're paid by the insurance companies, and sometimes through bonuses and different incentives that lead them to make more money when the employer spends more.
Yeah, talk about some of those other incentives. It isn't just more cash. There's some weird little perks that they might get if they sell the right kind of insurance to enough customers.
Well, I looked and I found all different types, you have to realize with healthcare, it's very localized. And so different states have different rules, different cities have different plans. But I found Cigna in one case offering a trip to Bermuda for their top selling brokers where they'd get to spend 5 days on the beach at one of the island's luxury resorts. I found another plan in New York that offered its top-selling brokers the chance to go to bat against the legendary New York Yankee pitcher Mariano Rivera. And other times it's just cash. I mean, I found some plans where if you enroll enough employees in a large group plan, you can get a bonus of $100,000, even up to $150,000. That's just for enrolling one large group with an insurance company.
Now, that would all be well and good, I guess, if it were the insurance company's own sales staff. But again, these are brokers who theoretically are advocating on behalf of not the insurance company, but the employer who's trying to buy insurance, right?
That's exactly right. Now, sometimes, insurance companies will have employed agents, and I don't think any broker or any employer would ever think that an employed agent is working on their behalf. But these are independent brokers, and they really do present themselves as independent advisors who are looking out for the best interests of the employers. And what I found is this is all a very evolving market. And right now, some of the brokers are changing the way they get paid. And they're saying that the traditional way is creating too many conflicts of interest for them. And so instead of getting paid through the insurance company, they're still getting paid a fee because the brokers do provide a valuable service. But instead of having it paid by the insurance company or having it built into the commission or into the premium, they're getting paid directly on a flat fee basis by the employers. And in some cases, they're even getting a bonus based on how much money they save the employer. And it's important to highlight here, we're not talking about saving the employer money by making the benefits worse, because that's actually been the way it's been done over the last 20 years. Anyone who gets their coverage through their employer probably notices a trend, and the trend is that the employee keeps paying more and keeps getting less for their money. That's been the trend over the last 20 years in the United States. The costs just get passed down to the little guy. But some of these brokers are coming up with creative benefit designs and creative benefit plans that cut out a lot of the middlemen that are really sucking a lot of our money out of our paychecks. And they're coming up with better plans with better benefits that actually reduce the cost for the employers and for the workers, believe it or not.
Talking to Marshall Allen, healthcare reporter for ProPublica, about a largely invisible part of the health insurance market, independent brokers who connect employers with insurance providers. Marshall, in your piece on this, you feature a company here in Wisconsin, actually, that's made a big change. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, this is really an amazing story. It's almost like a unicorn in the employee benefits world. This company called Palmer Johnson Power Systems, which is a heavy equipment distribution company in Madison, Wisconsin, they teamed up with a broker who was doing things a little bit different way. This guy, David Contorno, is affiliated with an organization called the Health Rosetta. And the Health Rosetta believes in being very transparent with employers, getting paid directly by employers. So anyway, they changed the incentives for this broker, and he came up with a benefit plan that improved the benefits and actually saved them so much money that in 2017, they saved so much money, they took all 120 employees on an all-expenses-paid trip to Vail, Colorado, where they rode four-wheelers and went whitewater rafting. And then the next year, 2018, the company saved so much money again that it rewarded each employee with a bonus check of about $700.
Is this, so that sounds like a success story, Marshall. Is this an idea that's catching on? Are more employers looking at a case like this and saying, hey, wait, I want in on that too?
It is catching on. And I think the reason it's catching on is because employers and workers cannot keep spending this kind of money. I mean, if you look at the typical American family, they have thousands of dollars less in their paychecks and their pockets right now than they did even, say, 5 years ago. And it's because the healthcare costs keep rising by 5 or 10% a year. That adds up. That's compounding interest in the wrong direction, and it is breaking employers and it's breaking employees. And so really they are desperate to find solutions that are unusual but still effective and that are not kind of the traditional way that the insurance companies have done things. And what they would say is it's really important to break free of the insurance industry payments, because right now the insurance industry keeps a lockdown on those brokers who they pay, because if those brokers go against what the insurance company does, they can get cut off by the insurance company and they can lose all their commissions and bonuses.
A weird incentive you found in a couple cases was companies that gave a first-year bonus. When you brought a new employer over to an insurance company, you got a big bonus. That incentivized what? Getting companies to change insurance plans every year?
Well, exactly. This is where, you know, you start getting into the nitty-gritty of this, and it's very complicated, and you can understand why employers aren't really familiar with it. But brokers told me about some of the supplemental benefits for, say, like cancer care or disability benefits or extra hospital care policies. Some of these commissions on these plans are 30%, 40%, 50% of the premium. I mean, they're extremely high. And you got to remember that it's the company or the employer and the worker who pays that commission, not the insurance company. So the insurance company doesn't mind making it really high, but they'll front load the commission. So the commissions might only be paying out at that rate, really high rate in the first year. And then that incentivizes the brokers to go to the employers every year and say, you need to switch to a different disability plan, or you need to switch to a different specialty cancer care plan, just because they keep loading up on that benefit in the first year of coverage.
And briefly, Marshall, you reached out to a lot of insurance companies to try to figure out their broker reward incentive structure. What did you hear back from them?
You know, the insurance companies told me, hey, we're not doing anything illegal. This is how it's always been done. We always encourage brokers to match employers with the best possible benefits. So the insurance companies, hey, look, they said, we're not doing anything wrong. And you know what? Technically, they're not. This is the way it's always been. It's just now people are starting to raise questions about this conflict of interest that's been baked into the process.
Marshall, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
That's Marshall Allen, healthcare reporter for ProPublica. He was with us to talk about his latest piece on health insurance brokers and their role in the rising costs of American health insurance, part of a longer ongoing series, actually, about the causes of high health insurance costs in the United States. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, before you left home this morning, did you grab an energy bar to eat during your commute, as a snack at your desk? Was it your actual breakfast or lunch today? According to our guest, bars are the hottest and maybe strangest category in natural foods. They're a $5 billion industry made up of dozens of brands and geared toward various kinds of specialty demands. You can find bars for breakfast, protein, women's nutrition, paleo, vitality, even meat. So how did Americans get so turned on to energy bars, and what does that say about us and the food we eat? Mark Peruzzi is the editorial director of Mountain Media and a contributing editor to Outside Magazine. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about when these, what we now call energy bars, first came on the scene a couple few decades ago. Where did they come from?
They kind of sprung up from the endurance sports crowd, you know, cyclists and endurance runners and that outdoor crowd. I wrote this article for Outside Magazine, and that's definitely our purview. And it was the first one to really go mainstream was a product called Power Bar, which you still see in stores quite a bit and is still alive today. And that came out in the late 80s, 1986. It was put together and they launched it in 1988. But it was a niche product back then, really, that mountain bikers embraced more than anybody.
And the idea was this was going to be something that was more convenient, right, and concentrated than having a plastic baggie filled with, I don't know what. What were people eating instead?
Yeah, back then you would have a little plastic baggie with some Fig Newtons in it and probably a banana in your jersey pocket. But those foods work really well, but you know, it's hard to jam a banana into a backpack, and you can't wrap a Fig Newton around the handlebar of your bike, which is what people did with those first power bars. You just kind of peel them off slice by slice from their handlebar covered in God knows what from the trail.
Now, over the years, I don't eat them so much lately, but over the years I have eaten a fair amount of various kinds of energy bars. I am not an endurance athlete, and I'm not alone. These things exploded beyond their original market. How did that happen?
It's truly bizarre to think about, but in the 1990s, those endurance athletes started to eat other products. They eat on gels, they're called. It's essentially a little blister pack of gelatin with sugar that you squeeze in your mouth on the bike. And then another product called a gel block, which is essentially like a chewy gelatin block that for quicker, easier energy. So energy bars should have almost died off at that point, but instead people began eating energy bars as meal replacements. And that's kind of where we're at today. It's turned into a $5 to $6 billion global industry of people eating all manner of energy bars instead of breakfast and more instead of lunch.
And from the original power bars, we see more and more new players in the market. And you share in your piece kind of, you know, a rags to riches dream for some people who started off baking stuff in their home kitchen and ended up with multi-million dollar companies. Can you talk about the days of that happening?
Yeah, it seems like this almost universal origin story for these companies. Gary Erickson from Clif Bar fame is probably the biggest success story. Clif Bar is now the biggest energy bar producer globally, as far as I know. And he, like you and I, he ate power bars on a bike, and he got to a point where he couldn't eat a single power bar. It's called bar fatigue in the industry. So he went home, and he wasn't much of a baker, but he tried to whip together some more natural ingredients into bar form. And a couple of years later, Clif Bar was launched, and it's a massive company. They hand out millions of bars each year, and that's kind of their number one form of marketing. It's just the bar handout.
Now, the big question about these bars are they really just upscale candy bars, or are they healthier for us? Are they healthy for endurance athletes? Are they healthy to replace that meal?
Well, there's a giant range of product on the market right now. They're all healthier, I would say, or almost all of them are healthier, I would say, than a traditional candy bar. You know, they feature real chocolate and a lot of nuts and nut butters. And those nuts and nut butters are good for you. But to replace a meal more than once or twice a week with them is from my reporting nutrition over the years, it's not a good idea. You should still be eating real foods. And some of them are really just glorified candy bars. You know, if you look at a Kind bar, which is a very simple list of ingredients, but it's in many ways it's kind of a deconstructed Snickers bar, meaning they put the chocolate on the bottom and the nuts up top, and you look at the nuts when you're in the store, but you buy it again and again probably because you like the taste of chocolate.
Talking to Mark Peruzzi, editorial director of Mountain Media, contributing editor to Outside Magazine, talking about the rise of energy bars from a niche product for athletes to a meal replacement, a snack for just about everybody. Mark, is the market for these energy bars getting saturated? Is there room for that home baker to grow that million dollar business now that there was, say, 15 years ago?
Yeah, my reporting kind of showed two different points on that. One source was like, you need to rethink how you get into this business, and you need to, you know, make some samples of your product. Maybe distribute them in the town where you live, and then immediately go after some sort of venture capital type money so that you can launch it nationally. And then another source who worked for Whole Foods as a global buyer for many years thinks that you can still do it the traditional method, which is bake up some product and bring it to a local grocery store and local coffee shop and go that way. And one brand, the RX bar, they did exactly that, and they just sold their company for many millions of dollars. They mixed together about four or five ingredients, made a bar, and went from CrossFit gym to CrossFit gym selling them with essentially their business card on the back of the packaging. And it took off with that audience, and that's a growing market of people.
Now, this idea that we can replace maybe our busy working lunch by just peeling open a label and eating one of these power bars, it seems like that says something about our priorities at work and in our food. Does this mean something, that we've turned to this super fast alternative to actually eating a meal?
Yeah, and there's kind of good news, bad news on that front too. And the good news is that, you know, Outside covers the outdoor industry and outdoors people, and they tend not to go sit down for a three martini lunch like my grandfather did back in the 1950s and 60s. They're skipping lunch and going for a run, and they're either eating these products before or after a run. But it also speaks to the fact that Americans just don't, one, bake anymore, because a lot of these products you can make something similar in your home, or really even cook anymore. And they're, you know, my wife was in the grocery store just the other day, and she saw somebody picking up about 15 to 20 of these of the same type of bar. they're eating these bars for lunch when they're not exercising, for breakfast, and possibly even dinner.
You are still skiing and biking, I imagine. Do you use energy bars as part of your fuel for that, or do you do something else now?
I do something else. I used those gel and gelatin block products for years on the bike, but now there's a company out of Vermont that just puts pure maple syrup into these little blister packs, and your body absorbs it really well, and it doesn't cause any stomach problems. And when I'm skiing, I kind of reverted to what I did before energy bars were around. I have, you know, some Fig Newtons or some dates and nuts, or just whole foods in a little wax paper bag, and call it good. Because these products are essentially the same thing, but they've been more processed and marketed, and you end up spending a lot more money on the pre-made stuff, and then. And I don't think it personally tastes as good.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Mark Peruzzi is the editorial director of Mountain Media and a contributing editor to Outside Magazine. We talked to him about the history and growing popularity of energy bars. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests dig into the new state budget plan unveiled later today by Governor Evers. Find out more and share your reactions tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Now, President Trump's former personal attorney Michael Cohen is testifying behind closed doors today before the House Intelligence Committee. That follows yesterday's public hearing in front of the House Oversight Committee. There he called the president a racist, a con man, and a cheat. He said Trump manipulated financial records, paid off women to silence affairs, and knew in advance that WikiLeaks would release emails damaging to Hillary Clinton during the 2016 presidential campaign. The president weighed in this morning from Vietnam, calling yesterday's proceedings a fake hearing.
He lied a lot, but it was very interesting because he didn't lie about one thing. He said no collusion with the Russian hoax. And I said, I wonder why he didn't just lie about that, too, like he did about everything else. I mean, he lied about so many different things. And I was actually impressed that he didn't say, well, I think there was collusion for this reason or that. He didn't say that. He said no collusion.
So what now? Mark Osler is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, a lot came out of that hearing yesterday. What was your main takeaway? What stuck out to you the most?
Well, the emotion of it was a big part of it. And, you know, unfortunately, I think some of the more important parts were obscured by the grandstanding on both sides. That, you know, I've testified in front of a congressional panel, and a lot of times you're just hearing them say what they think as opposed to hearing what the witnesses think. But in terms of what we did hear, a lot of it was confirming things that we already knew. You know, that we'd at least caught a glimpse of. For example, the Trump Tower Moscow, the fact that there were negotiations on that going on well into 2016. Cohen had already pled guilty to that, in fact, to lying about that to the Senate. So that really wasn't new information. There were some bits of new information that we saw, the story about Roger Stone telling the president about the coming WikiLeaks dump of information was new, I think, to a lot of people. And, you know, some of the more salacious things, the allegation of racism, certainly. Now, those things like the discussion of racist comments, aren't going to go directly into what we're going to see come out in the larger picture when we see the Mueller report and the work done by the investigators in the Southern District of New York.
Now, nobody, I think, will ever face prosecution based solely on the words of Michael Cohen. What stuck out to you as things that could be corroborated by documents maybe subpoenaed by Robert Mueller or by a House committee?
Yeah, I suspect that you're talking about two different things there, that Robert Mueller has probably already subpoenaed or received the things that corroborate what he cares about. They're coming to the end game in theirs. Now, what the House committee might look at next probably will relate to financial records and things like that. In terms of corroborating what he talked about, there were some incidents like the straw purchase of a painting of Donald Trump that was purchased by the charity that he ran. You know, that's probably illegal in the use of the charitable funds. There's already been a fair amount of corroboration of that, of other people talking about it that have confirmed some of the details that, that Cohen provided. When we look at the Trump Tower, the discussions of the Trump Tower of Moscow, which was supposed to be Europe's tallest building if they built it, it was quite a project that was being proposed. I suspect that those discussions are being corroborated or have been corroborated by the Mueller investigators. The Southern District of New York, what they're looking at more is financial transactions that are going to back up some of the claims that are made, particularly dealing with the payoff to Stormy Daniels. That, you know, he had the check, he showed the check, it had Donald Trump's distinctive signature on there, and certainly that showed that he was being paid for something. But there's certainly more thorough financial records than that, and those are going to end up in the hands of the investigators.
Oh, in that clip we heard from President Trump, he focused on something that Michael Cohen didn't talk about as much, so-called collusion with Russia by the president and his people. Did you see Michael Cohen avoiding that topic or not really touching that? Is that good news for the president?
Well, I probably in the sense that Michael Cohen didn't have that testimony, it's good news for the president. But there's a way in which it's bad news for the president, too, almost as he seemed to reflect in his public statement, the president. It adds to Cohen's credibility a little bit that he was conceding things that he didn't know. Another point that was like that was when he said he had no reason to think that the tape of Donald Trump's escapades in Russia that was part of the Steele dossier exists. And that was a concession that if Cohen's goal was simply to slander Trump in any way possible, he probably, and he was a liar, he would have lied and said that that tape was real and that he, you know, seen evidence of it.
Talking to Mark Osler, professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, looking at yesterday's testimony by Michael Cohen before the House Oversight Committee and the reaction since then. Mark, it's been commented on a lot at this point. The key goal of Republicans on that committee seemed to be to discredit the credibility of Michael Cohen. Do you think that they successfully did that?
No, not really. I mean, not any more than he was already discredited. I mean, you had a witness there who'd already been convicted of lying to Congress and had pled guilty to lying to Congress. There's really no better impeachment than that. And what they tried to pile on, I'm not sure added very much. From his perspective, Cohen did a pretty good job of trying to explain why that was then and this is now. In the sense that he decided to fly straight and tell the truth. You know, that may not have been completely true, of course. One of the things that he said is that he never wanted to work in the White House, and today there's significant voices coming out to the contrary on that claim, at least.
And there's talk from some leading House Republicans who were there, Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, I believe, referring those particular statements to the Department of Justice to see if, in fact, Michael Cohen had lied to Congress again, which presumably would affect his plea deal and his ultimate sentence.
Yeah, it would be a tough thing to prosecute because what someone wants is isn't a firm thing. It's not like saying that this action happened on this date and then that's not true. Saying that I wanted this or I didn't want that. You know, a lot of times we want something and we don't tell anyone, or we don't want something, but we indicate to people advertently or inadvertently that we do. So I think that would be a tougher charge than some of the ones that have already been brought in and proven by plea against Cohen.
We've talked about a lot of the legal outcomes of this so far, and we'll look at those some more. Politically, did yesterday matter? Is this something that you think voters anywhere across the spectrum are looking at and being swayed by?
Perhaps. I mean, one thing that it was hard not to watch that hearing and think this is the person that Donald Trump trusted the most. In the way that might have been worked against what the Republicans were doing, because every time they went on about what a terrible person Cohen was, it certainly was at the back of my mind, but this is the terrible person that the Trump organization and the president himself trusted with some of his most sensitive tasks.
Do you expect to see follow-up hearings now toward the end? Michael Cohen was asked and gave the names of other people who could provide more information about a lot of the topics that came up, and are providing 3, 4, 5 different names. Do you expect to see more hearings with some of the people whose names came up then?
Yeah, I think we very well could, given that Democrats control the House and have the power to have these hearings. I think that we will see hearings in the future. Now, one of the things that's fascinating to me is that you've got 2 days of closed hearings and the 1 day of open hearings. And it could be that some of the reason that we have closed hearings is because what Cohen is talking about relates to ongoing investigations. And once those investigations are concluded, probably the SDNY, the Southern District of New York investigation, and the Mueller investigation, then they could even go back to Cohen and bring him back again and have open hearings on some of the things that are closed for now.
We're talking about the fallout from the Michael Cohen testimony yesterday with Mark Osler. He's a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of what Michael Cohen had to say? Is he exposing important details about who President Trump is and what he's done? Or do you agree with House Republicans that he is in no way a credible witness, that he has lied to Congress in the past and he can't be trusted now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the congressional testimony of Michael Cohen, President Trump's former personal lawyer, and where things go from here. Mark Osler is our guest, professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What stood out to you the most about what Cohen had to say? Do you think his testimony is trouble for President Trump, or is he just not a credible witness? Do you agree with House Republicans that this was a waste of time, or with House Democrats that we're getting important information here from a key confidant, former confidant of the president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mark, there's been some talk at the CPAC, this conservative political action group meeting, from Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows, saying that, hey, this is the Democrats. This hearing was the Democrats trying to lay their first foundations toward impeachment. Do you see that?
Well, I don't think in a direct way. If there is a movement towards impeachment, that's going to build off the Mueller report. That once we see that report, it's highly unlikely that Robert Mueller is going to seek an indictment against the president, just because he's a company man, and that's not the policy of the Department of Justice. It is possible, I'm not saying it's likely, but it's certainly possible, that the report may lay out the foundation for impeachment. And I think that's what the Democrats are going to be looking to closely, because it's a risky thing. They don't want to go into that process without a firm foundation, and the Mueller report might supply that, especially given that, remember, the charges are brought by the House, but the trial itself is in the Senate, and the Senate is still controlled by the Republicans. So it's unlikely, unless things change a lot, that we would see a conviction come out of that trial.
Let's go to our callers now. Glenn is with us in Brookfield. Glenn, hello.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Glenn?
Just my comment is that I think that if we say that anybody has criminal activity can't be a credible witness, that would certainly stagnate the courts, because they use that prolifically, especially in putting felons away and mafiosos. They've used witnesses who've had checkered past and deemed them as credible witnesses when they came forward in a court. And I think Cohen's testimony can't be just thrown away by saying, well, you lied in the past, therefore everything you say can't be taken as a credible evidence.
Glenn, thanks for the call. Mark, Glenn's saying, hey, courts are full of witnesses with maybe shady backgrounds, but they still bring important information.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I was a federal prosecutor myself for 5 years and used the testimony of people who had been convicted of felonies. There is a difference, though. If the prior felony is for selling narcotics, that's different than a prior conviction for perjury, where it's specifically about lying under oath. And I think there is a point of differentiation there that's pretty important that we have with Cohen, as opposed to those cases where we have people who have been convicted of street crimes or things that don't necessarily involve lying in that direct way.
Glenn, thanks for the call. Nancy joins us next in Minocqua. Nancy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I wanted to say that I thought NPR did a fantastic job with the coverage yesterday. And that I thought Michael Cohen did a great job. I thought they got a lot of information that the Democrats asked him a lot of good questions. And I was pretty much disappointed in the Republicans because they really didn't ask him any questions. They just talked a lot about newspaper articles that had been written about Cohen and things that he had done wrong.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Mark, can you talk about the Republican strategy? We mentioned attacking the credibility of Michael Cohen, raising the thought that he might be angling for book or movie rights. Some even Republicans have pointed out the one thing they didn't do a lot of was defending President Trump from the charges that Michael Cohen was raising through this hearing.
That was surprising. I expected at least somebody on the Republican side to speak affirmatively about Donald Trump and what he had done or hadn't done. And we did not see that. In terms of the Republican tactics, I think it did backfire to some degree, at least in the eyes of a lot of people who aren't Democrats that I've talked to, that the easy target was there, but they may have been a little heavy-handed in the way they approached it. And they probably didn't shake his credibility the way that they had hoped to.
Right. And Michael Cohen thought of as a very controversial, confrontational figure over the years. There's audio of him swearing, for example, at a current NPR reporter in a private phone call. And yet here they said, you're terrible. And yeah, I'm terrible. I'm paraphrasing right there, but that kept happening again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And once again, that, you know, they're saying you're terrible. He's saying I'm terrible. And a lot of us are sitting there watching that, thinking this is the kind of person the president surrounds himself with. And that's not, in the end, the outcome they probably wanted.
Let's bring on another caller now. Ron joins us in Madison. Ron, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Ron?
Well, I'm a lifelong Republican for more than 55 years. Grew up in Idaho, which is strongly Republican. I'm not a Trumpian. And although Cohen's testimony may be weak because of his credibility may be weak because of his past lying, but what he says, for the most part, seems to correspond with what I've observed in the last 30 years. And I find that Trump behaves like a middle school bully. And he's fluent in newspeak.
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Not quite making out everything you're saying because of the line, but Mark, in general, Ron's saying he's a Republican, doesn't necessarily trust Michael Cohen, but what Michael Cohen said lines up with what he's seen from Donald Trump over the years.
Yeah, and I think that was the response of a lot of people across the spectrum, that, for example, when Michael Cohen testified that he probably had made over 500 calls to people basically to rough them up a little, to scare them if they'd said negative things about the president, that was consistent with what we knew about him and what we'd seen from other aspects of the administration. It's interesting. One of my childhood friends is a former AP reporter named Ron Fournier, and he's one of the people that Cohen called during that time. It was a pretty common experience, apparently, for people in the press. That kind of behavior, It is credible in a sense because there's a consistency with other behaviors that we've seen by those who are close to the president.
Thanks, Ron, for the call. We are talking to Mark Osler from the University of St. Thomas about Michael Cohen's testimony before a House committee yesterday. Back to your calls now. Gloria is with us in Platteville. Gloria, hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I think you're doing a great job here. Well, there's one thing that hasn't been mentioned that Mr. Cohen mentioned was that Mr. Trump is a racist, and not only being a con artist and supposedly lying every three and a half minutes and doing all these crazy things with the Trump and with Russia, then we've got somebody that's a racist on top of it all. So, you know, I believe Mr. Cohen.
I'm going to jump in because, again, your line isn't great, but she is getting back to that Michael Cohen mentioning a couple of racist statements that he said the president made, something that probably can't be corroborated, in documents. Can you talk about the impact of that, though, Mark?
Yeah, I think it did have an impact, in part because it wasn't a vague allegation of racism. It was in a kind of earthy story that they're driving through Chicago, and Donald Trump looks out the window and says that you know, only black people could live this way. And it's consistent with some of the other things that he said, that when he made an appeal for black votes, saying, what have you got to lose, implying that black people in this country are uniformly at the bottom of society, that you know, what he said had that air of reality to it because of the context and because of the larger context from what we've seen from this president in the past.
Thanks for your call, Gloria. Mark, in our last minute or so, there are a lot of moving parts here. What are you watching for next?
I'm watching for the release of the Mueller report. It is going to patch up a lot of these things. Now, of course, we may not see it right away. It is going to go to the Department of Justice, and then they face the decision of whether or not to forward it to Congress. And if they do not forward it to Congress, will Congress make other efforts to get that report? But I do believe that we are sooner rather than later going to see that report. And once we do, these different parts of the story that we've seen in isolation, an indictment here, Cohen's testimony there, a release of information over there, suddenly we're going to be looking at the whole picture. And things are going to be much, much clearer.
Briefly, though, even if that report dropped tomorrow, there's still the Southern District of New York investigations that we don't necessarily know what they're investigating, right?
That's true. And I think that when we end up seeing the indictments of people in the Trump circle, many of them will be out of that investigation from the Southern District of New York.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mark Osler is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas. We talked to them about the fallout from Michael Cohen's congressional testimony and what it means for President Trump's political and legal future. Yesterday's session before the House Oversight Committee was the only public hearing for Cohen. He testified behind closed doors on Tuesday for the Senate Intelligence Committee, today before the House Intelligence Committee. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get reactions to the governor's big budget announcement tonight, and you can join the show with your priorities when it comes to taxes and spending in Wisconsin. Listen live, by the way, to that budget address starting tonight at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Also tomorrow, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Our guest brings us some recipes for cooking with cheese. And Going Once, Going Twice, Sold. A Wisconsin auctioneer tells us what it takes to run an auction, and I think I'm going to get some vocal coaching on how to talk really fast. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, meet the creators of a series of children's books published here in Wisconsin based on the experiences of real kids from all walks of life. It's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, Wisconsin saw an increase in farmers filing for bankruptcy in 2018. We'll learn what factors are pushing farms to seek those bankruptcy protections and what it can mean for the state in the future. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.